Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. Tanya Pacheco-Warner on the show. Dr. Pacheco-Warner is a sociologist and public health researcher known for her work in health equity and social determinants of health, especially in California's Central Valley. She currently serves as the executive director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State, focusing on data-driven policies to address health disparities among underserved communities. Dr. Pacheco-Warner's expertise is widely sought in areas of community health, environmental justice, and policymaking that impacts rural populations. This was a fantastic conversation. We dig into all things public health in the Central Valley, as well as broader conversations about medicine and more. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Tanya Pacheco-Warner, and Baker will take us there.
To infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best!
Dr. Pacheco-Warner, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
I would say that it's a tie between Tacos Tijuana on Belmont and Don Pepe's, any of the locations.
Okay. And what's your order at those respective places? Is it the same thing, or is there something specific to each of those places you
like?
Oh,
gosh. So at Tacos Tijuana, definitely the fried fish, the mojarra, that is my favorite because that is definitely something I would never do at home. But I'm glad.
Yeah, I've never actually ordered fish from them before. Tell me about it.
Yeah, it's a fried fish, and then they have all these sauces at the table that you can just put on it and have a blast with it. And my kids like to look at the eyes and pick out the tail, so that makes it a little extra colorful.
Perfect. And what about Don Pepe's? What's your order there?
Oh, definitely some of the best tacos de lengua, the beef tongue tacos. Definitely my favorite there.
And what's your, I feel like there's gradations in how tongue is prepared. And I prefer it like a little bit crispier on the outside than maybe it would be normally. What's your kind of golden mean?
You know what? I have yet to try. People have talked about making it really crispy and then soft on the inside. I have yet to try such a thing. And I think I would love it. But I really love like the standard soft, and then you can add all the salsas in the world to it. That's my style.
Perfect. Well, I think we're pretty aligned on that. So I've got a ton of questions to ask you about health and medicine. And I'm really excited to talk to you because there's so many different areas where I have a lot of interest, but not a lot of knowledge. And I would love to learn from you about health in the Valley. I want to start by talking about you a little bit, though. And as a child, did you make any connections between environment and health?
When I was a kid, I really didn't understand that when I was young, I grew up right next to the rail yard on Clinton and 99. And I did not understand until much later, until now, in one of my roles, seeing people come from all over California and talk to us about the impact of living so close to industry and what that's done for their bodies or their kids' bodies or loved ones. It didn't dawn on me as a young person. And really, I came to understand health and the environment as part of my own work and part of into adulthood, actually, with my being pregnant with my first child.
Wow. So you studied sociology both in your undergraduate work and graduate work. I've got a couple questions about that. How do you think studying sociology changes a person's perspective on human nature?
Yeah, I like to tell people that once sociology teaches you how the world works, you can't unsee it. And for me, it really was about helping understand how everything from not just how you live inside your household, but when you go outside, the sidewalks you walk to and from, if there are sidewalks, the air you breathe, to how much you're paying for rent and how all that interacts with one another and in terms of chances for you to get the best education, to get the best jobs, to get the best ability for your family. All of those things being interconnected for me, learning about that has been one of the best privileges of my life, really, to be able to get such an education and then being able to apply it for sure. Sometimes that's why when I tell people, yeah, I'm a public health researcher, but I also work on housing issues. Sometimes people scratch their head, but it's like, for me, I only view the world as a sociologist. I only view the world as how everything is interconnected.
Yeah. And medical sociology is so fascinating to me. And obviously, it was incredibly relevant during the pandemic and is obviously relevant all the time. But that expertise and understanding how societies work and how medical knowledge is disseminated is critically important. And I want to ask you specifically about that around how medical knowledge is produced. How do we make that more equitable, you think?
I think in terms of the production of knowledge, I think it's also like how decisions are made can also be more equitable in terms of what we even think of as knowledge. And one of the key things that I've strived to do in my work is really help systems see the value in community engagement and help folks understand, hey, you have this big problem to solve, like why people aren't showing up for their doctor's appointments. And you can try to apply journal articles and best practices applied nationally. But have you ever tried asking the residents themselves why they're not showing up? And so I think that sometimes we forget that people are actually the experts of their own lives, right? And so for me, that's a part of making medical knowledge more equitable. Now, another piece that I really didn't understand when I was younger, and I really appreciate now having aging parents and having being in that middle space where you have little kids, but then you also have aging grandparents and parents and having to think about all of that, is really the importance of literacy and having access to knowledge and really understanding why is that medication so important for you to take, but also back to the healthcare system, do we understand what barriers that person has to taking that medication? And some of it can be a lack of understanding, but some of it can also be a lack of actually having a conversation and understanding all the barriers that person faces on the everyday life to help make them their health successful as it can be.
That leads me to a question I was going to ask later, but I'll ask now. How do we judge the effectiveness of public awareness campaigns around health and medical information? Like, how do we know that they're successful?
For me, we really got to test this during COVID when we implemented our outreach campaign using community health workers in Fresno County and really understanding that having culturally concordant, meaning people that share the same culture were also the ones sharing the knowledge. What we got to see is that while Fresno County ranked among the worst and a lot of indicators when it came to public health, they weren't at the very bottom when it came to COVID because of using this very targeted strategy of meeting people where they were, speaking their own language, meeting them in their actual place, and just speaking their own language, both language-wise and culturally. So I think in the rankings, you can definitely see that. One of the things that we also have seen when we've studied initiatives that have gone on for a long period of time, like 10 years, is that we also have seen, are people more involved in the decision making? So not necessarily you've seen the needle move very drastically on, say, like diabetes. However, are they now more involved in their children's schools? Are they now on some of the school boards? Are they now part of attending city council meetings, board of supervisors meetings, and really being a decision maker, being having civic engagement, we know can have that long-term effect on people's health as well.
So another thing that I think about a lot and probably came up in medical sociology is, are there certain social factors that you think need to be covered more in the discipline? I'm thinking about things like personality, extroversion, introversion, birth order. I think there's a lot of areas where we have a lot of strengths. Are there any gaps that you see that would help us make better decisions around community health that maybe haven't been explored yet?
One of the things that we're really trying to grasp with now is the lack of understanding of what developmental delays or challenges kids face. So there is a real lack of screening and data and access to data about screening for kids. And I'm talking about before they start school, all the way to those first, before third grade. Are we getting them tested for ADHD? Do we know their ACEs? Do we understand if they have any other learning delays that we should understand and know about that are just maybe about how their brain may work different? Not necessarily, you can think about it, just a different learning ability, right? We really see the lack of understanding in that. And unfortunately, the data is not very coordinated. So what people may be getting in their doctor's office may not be getting to the school, and vice versa. And so I think that there's a huge opportunity to really have one more concerted community efforts to get kids the right screening before they start school, and then right when they start school, and when you start seeing those differences. And then definitely for communities to have access to that data. What's happening in our community? Do we need more after-school programs targeted for littles? Do we need more resilience programs that are targeted for those very littles that are struggling with a lot of adverse childhood experiences? So those types of things I really feel like are things that we're learning now, especially post-COVID, that we need to understand more.
Something that came up recently when I was talking to my partner, who's a clinical psychologist, and we were talking about she was looking for a new therapist for herself. And I was talking to her about trying the process of seeking a new provider. In your expertise and background, do you think that people should try to pursue providers that match them in as many areas of their demographic information as possible? Whether it's gender, whether it's ethnicity, whether it's background, or do you think choosing a provider based on that could lead to some potential blind spots? We were having a discussion about this. I'd be curious your perspective.
I think definitely at the very fundamental place for people to even know that they have rights and responsibilities as patients is a really important part of health literacy that we don't cover enough. And it's something that we at the at my institute actually train community health workers on, is that doctor-patient communication, and that those rights and responsibilities are a key part of health literacy. So even understanding that you can change doctors is a huge thing. However, I would say that when it comes to the decision making, some of my own research, especially with older Mexican immigrant men, has found that it really doesn't matter the provider. It really matters on the communication front, how the communication happens. So definitely, if there's a language barrier, that is going to have put a strain on the communication between the patient and the provider. However, I will say that communication can also come from the provider understanding the intrinsic motivations of the person in terms of why do they want to be healthy, what are their goals, and really understanding what are their barriers too. So if somebody can understand that and meet that person where they're at, and the person as well can be empowered with their health literacy and understanding how they can communicate and ask for more information, I think that's where we can see effective provider-patient relationships.
Is there anything that COVID caused you to change your mind about in the medical space?
I think for me, one of the key learnings about COVID was really that everyone has a goal for their life. And it doesn't necessarily match what we think is going to make them the healthiest. And we really need to accept that. For example, among the Asian American Pacific Islander community, we saw that there was a lot of fear around being separated, somebody seeking treatment because they were afraid they were going to die in a hospital. And that was a really core thing about themselves that they did not want to live through. And when they did see, for example, we saw one that their spouse did die in a hospital. And then when that person got sick, they said, this was so outside of our cultural experience to die alone. that is not something that I'm willing to do. And that was really hard to understand, especially when you want to keep somebody healthy and you want to keep them, but really understanding that there are meanings and to life that are greater than just punching you with that vaccine and getting you on your way. You know, that there are a lot of things around deep cultural meaning are a part of a person's health too.
You naturally led to my next question, which is about hospitals. Hospitals have been in the news for many reasons recently in the San Joaquin Valley, from the Madera Hospital closing to the apparent misallocation of funds in the community health system. Hospitals are struggling in many ways. I was deeply influenced by Elizabeth Rosenthal's book, An American Sickness, that looked at the business of hospitals. What's your kind of general picture or your kind of interpretive lens for how to think about the role hospitals play in the Central Valley and their viability without huge, I guess at this point, we can call what's happening with the Madera Hospital a bailout in many ways to keep it open. What's your kind of perspective on the situation with hospitals here in the Valley?
Actually encouraged about where we are as a local community thinking about hospitals. I think so for so long we've thought about hospitals as this very top-down approach. Hospitals tell you what to do, when to do it, and they mind their own business and you mind your own business. And what we've seen from these two instances is that no, hospitals are actually an integral part of our community. And we all have a stake in them. And that they do, because they receive public funds, they do have something to answer to back to the to their own communities that they are serving. And they should be open to engage in those healthy conversations. And so I think that even though it was very devastating, what happened in the Madera Hospital, especially for people that had to travel now much further to get the care they needed. I think it also opened up the door for how do we actually, as a community, envision a hospital working for us, not the other way around, right? So I think that's a healthy conversation. I hope it continues. And I hope we're able to, and all parties are able to see that as a productive way of moving forward, of really seeing it not just as a community asset that does things for us, but how do we make it work for us too?
I just recorded a podcast with some of the leadership at the VA here in Fresno. And one of the things that they talk about was the vision of having a lot more community-based clinics as opposed to centralized services, where maybe you go to the hospital for certain kinds of high-level specialized procedures, but a lot of your experience with the medical system will be at a distributed network. Do you think that's the kind of future that we're seeing? A lot of things distributed across a larger area as opposed to centralized services in one facility?
I think it's going to need to be an all approach, right? We definitely need to decentralize some of the services because of the way that people are moving out, because of the cost of living. We do see more disbursement into some of the places that were traditionally rural areas becoming more suburban. So that is definitely going to happen. And it is also a great way to think about, as our population ages, how do we provide that added access to people that can't get on the freeway and come into town to receive care? I also think that it's important that we keep thinking about how some of those specialty care functions continue to operate in an effective way that doesn't bankrupt a healthcare system. Because I am a big believer in having access to specialty care. And in order to make that equitable, sometimes it's not the best approach isn't to have like an MRI in every little town, right? It is to have some of those core services a little bit more centralized, or think of a new and innovative way to do that. So I definitely think that decentralizing some of this is key to providing more access. And I think ensuring that our local residents have access to high quality specialty care still continues to be a priority.
Okay, two questions on health and housing. So, how could health outcomes be affected if we grow our affordable housing stock in Fresno?
One of the key things that we find is that there are certain things that people will compromise in order to meet their basic needs. And definitely at the top of those things that people sacrifice is their own health. So when we think about basic needs, like putting food on the table for their families, diapers for their babies, and a roof over their head, those are going to be the top priorities. And so what we see is that then other things will start to suffer because of that. And so if we see that people are less housing burdened, meaning that they're not spending all of their paycheck on housing, then they are able to think about how to invest that money in other things that help them keep healthier. We have seen this in larger studies where people's health actually does improve over time when they've done these big longitudinal studies and they've said, you're going to live in an affordable but nice neighborhood and we're going to help you. The self-reported health of those people has improved over time. And so we know that when housing isn't what's taking over all of your income, you are able to think about wellness. You are able to think about meeting those other things that we think are basic needs, but that people forfeit in order to keep a roof over their head.
Should high quality central air conditioning in every home be a right that humans should expect? We see what happens when cities where there's not air conditioning and they have heat surges over the summer, people die. Should it be a basic right that everyone should have air conditioning?
I think that we should definitely look at the data. And the data tells us there is something called California heat, where anybody can go and look and see the projections over the next 20, 30 years about how many more heat events are expected to happen in any given community. And the reality is that, much like we experienced this last summer, we are going to have more extreme heat events and then also higher temperatures overall. So, what does that mean? When we think about labor has done some of that work already for us and really found that anything above 85 degrees really starts to get very uncomfortable for a human. 95 degrees, you really need some protection. Your health really starts beginning to suffer. And definitely anything above that, you really need relief from. So when we think about it from that perspective, that our temperatures are going to get higher, and they already are, and we are already seeing it, right? Whether we believe in climate change or not, we are seeing it, right? When we know that's going to happen more, and we know that from some of the way in which labor already thinks, like Cal OSHA in particular, already thinks about the health of a human being, we know people need to have access to relief in one way or another, and it should definitely be part of housing. Now, how we do that in a way that continues to be affordable for people to live in that housing, that's the real challenge. And I think that we should also, as we think about air conditioning, we should also be thinking about innovation in how housing is made to be cooler, how buildings are made, how buildings are renovated, and also how we can continue to tap on some of these emerging technologies to make it more affordable. So, for example, I've been working with a pair of fellows out of Stanford who are building a prototype to have a microgrid, a solar grid in people's apartments so that they could hook up some really basic appliances and being able to save on energy in that way. And things like that, we need more of so that people can have a more affordable way to keep cool, because both of those things go hand in hand. Having access to relief from the heat and not being energy burdened are going to be key things as the temperatures continue to rise.
Okay, we're going to jump into my favorite section now, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. You tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. Okay, so we'll start with a concept. This concept comes from Cass Sunstein, the concept of the nudge. It's where governments encourage people to make better choices by nudging them in the right direction. Do you think this is over or underrated?
I think it's overrated. I just have not seen it work in my lifetime.
Do you think it's overly paternalistic trying to give people, in the vein of your what you were talking about during COVID, where someone had maybe a different goal than the health industry wanted them to pursue? Like they didn't want to die alone in a hospital, and maybe we were encouraging them that way? Or is it, do you think about it differently?
I think about it in the other way, in which I was talking about earlier, is that often we don't understand people's intrinsic motivation enough to make correct messaging. So I think sometimes we make these messages about what people should do without understanding about why people would even do them in the first place.
Okay. Next one. Me and Ed's Pizza.
Oh my goodness. This is a very controversial one.
It is. Strangely, it is for a lot of people.
It's the most controversial thing you've asked me thus far. I think that it is overrated.
Okay. Explain.
And I still love it. And I love their ranch. I personally do. But I do think that sometimes when I see I have to wait in line for 20 minutes to get a pizza, I'm like, there's a lot of great pizza places in town.
All right. Next one. The concept of the medical gaze. This comes from Michel Foucault, which is basically the idea that doctors objectify patients in the way they perceive them.
Underrated.
Okay.
Underrated,
can you explain?
For sure. I think that we don't talk enough about how much bias people carry into the, let's say, the ER triage room, the specialty care room, even the laboratory. And studies have shown all of that to be true. And even for me, as an educated person in this field, whenever I have to have an emergency room experience, I tell my husband, this is really hard for me because I know that when I walk in, I am not any of my degrees. I am not any of my published work. I am only, to some, I will only be seen as a fat Latina mom. And that will have so many consequences and has had consequences in terms of the care that I get. And I think that is something that we don't talk about enough, and we don't train doctors enough in, or providers enough in.
Next one, health advice on TikTok. It's great at disseminating things, but sometimes those things can be wrong.
Yeah, I think it's underrated because I think that we could be using it a lot better than we do if we were to be more engaged in it, as if health systems were to be more engaged and actually engage with some of those creators that are most popular out there and engage in a respectful way. I think that we could probably use that for a lot more good.
Okay. Next one. And this is someone that I've done quite a bit of reading on. I was curious your perspective. The work of Gabor and really thinking about trauma as the skeleton key that unlocks all the different medical conditions and illnesses that society struggles with.
I will say both overrated and underrated. Overrated in terms of that I think that people talk about it a lot and it's popular to think about, and people have monetized wellness a lot and wearing yoga pants and doing fancy retreats. And it's underrated because that doesn't get at the core of what Gabor Mate is really talking about in terms of how to have those under the deep understanding of any sort of trauma, and really thinking about even how racism can be a trauma, and a $20 smoothie is not going to solve that. And so I think it's both underrated and underrated, that I think the deep meaning of what he's talking about and the deep work, I think we should all take note and take part in, and not just think about it as a surface.
Okay. The next one's kind of a tough one, so I apologize in advance. Baby elephants over...
Underrated. All the way. I don't know. I'm waiting for all the baby elephant merch to come out of the Fresno Chaffee Zoo to spend my paycheck in.
Yeah. There's two of them, right?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. It sucks me in every time I open up that stupid app and I see a picture. I'm like, all right, there goes 10 minutes. So I can't get enough either.
Those ears are just irresistible.
All right. Next one. And you actually brought this up in a prior answer, but I was curious to just have you expand on it. Microgrids. Can you maybe explain? Because I assume you believe it's underrated. Maybe you can explain what the technology is.
Yes. This is like the most underrated thing. One of the things that we know about the San Joaquin Valley is that people are paying way too much for their energy, and we need better solutions. A lot of it comes from inefficient buildings and definitely how much energy costs is part of it. But there's also these alternative solutions like microgrids where you can actually have enough of a solar panel and maybe combination with other things like for bigger projects like fuel cells, you can combine these so that you actually don't need to solely rely on the things that are coming out from the natural gas pipeline or the even the electricity that's being brought to you by your energy provider. So just think about it like a mega solar panel, right? Not just what's on your house, your rooftop, but really thinking about it more as a complex. And so people can actually have that in their own. They could do microgrids in their neighborhood. They could for their whole neighborhood. They could do microgrid projects for buildings where, let's say, for example, especially rural areas where it's tough to get connections out there, they could actually have their own system. And I do think that it's a way to help alleviate a lot of what I see as the key barrier to moving us to the next level in the San Joaquin Valley and helping us catch up with Los Angeles and the Bay Area, which is our access to reliable and efficient and affordable energy.
Okay. Two more in this overrated versus underrated section. The next one is a pretty famous book in the medical sociology world, The Medicalization of Society by Peter Conrad, which just essentially looks at how more and more of human life is framed through a medical lens. Do you think that concept is over or underrated now?
Oh, that's really at the core of so much of my studies. And I think that it is probably when I was younger, I used to think it was very overrated. And now I'm seeing that some issues we have to look through a medical lens in order to really solve it, because some of the other things we've tried just haven't worked. And I think one of those key ones that we see is the drug use problem. Yeah, I think that bringing that into a medical lens, not in the way in which maybe we were talking about before when he was writing, we didn't know what we know now about the brain, about epigenetics, about trauma. And so I think that more and more understanding things more and more from a medical lens is more valuable today than it was maybe
Okay.
20 years ago.
Last one, cooling centers. And I'm curious about your perspective on this because I'm a big believer working in the government and looking at the way people's time is taxed by the government in order for them to get access to services. Cooling centers, they're not distributed all across the city, they're in centralized locations. And so for people to seek cool during heat waves, they have to leave their house, disrupt childcare, maybe they were working from home and they've got to remove all those things. There's a lot that goes into cooling centers. Do you think cooling centers are an under or overrated solution to heat?
In two ways. So one way, they are definitely underrated when it comes to having more access to them. So I definitely think that like a threshold of 105 degrees to go into a cooling center is way too hot. And I do see the challenges with funding something being open 3 months out of the year because it's getting to be so hot all the time. So I think that they're underrated in that they could be used more and we could have more of them. I think that they are overrated as thinking about them as the only solution to our heat problem. One of the biggest things that we know and understand now is that science from around the world has shown that more green space and the right type of green space can actually have a cooling effect in a community. And so implementing those in communities where we know they feel the burden of being very hot and not being able to afford turning up the AC. I think implementing some of those solutions could also pay off much more in the long run as well.
All right, let's transition to talking about air quality. I bet a bunch of people would recognize your face from those commercials, those air quality commercials. I've got a couple air quality questions for you. What causes bad air quality?
It really is a combination of factors for us in the San Joaquin Valley. When we think about Fresno in particular, I will say that it is a combination of our goods movement, how we're moving, being a car dependent place, because so much of our pollution comes from the particulate matters that is being exhausted by our cars and our trucks that are moving in our roads and highways. So that is a big contributor to our air pollution. The other piece is thinking through our industrial, we could think about our industrial pollution, which in our case also covers agriculture, right? So it's a combination of our agricultural and our industrial pollution, thinking about the way that the dust comes from shaking trees when during harvest season, right? But also the trucks coming in and out hauling those goods, and the tractors that some of them are very old, although we've transitioned so many of those successfully over the last 10 years. We still have a long way to go. And finally, definitely our geography, where we're at in a basin, definitely affects. You can see during the summer, those communities that push against the foothills, how they experience higher ozone, for example, than other communities because they are getting the combination of hitting the all of the pollution hitting against those foothills and the heat, right? And so I know that a lot of people don't like to just focus on our geography, that we're a basin, but that is an important contributor to our poor air quality.
Yeah, some of the things that come up when I talk to people about it is they've mentioned fireplaces a lot and people moving to pellet stoves. And I wonder how much relative to industry and our auto dependent society, how much actual the kind of the burn days or whatever, how much that has actually contributed to improving our air quality. Has it made a marked difference, or is that just the low hanging fruit that's relatively easy to address?
No, it is a big contributor during the winter. It really is a big contributor to our pollution. And one of the challenges that we have in the winter in the San Joaquin Valley is this inversion layer. So we are trapped. So our air is trapped. So when we think about fireplaces during the winter, when we have that inversion layer, we can think about grandpa smoking in the house. That's what we are doing. Right? That's what we are doing to our valley when we light our fireplace in the winter, because it just sits there. It has nowhere else to go. And so it really does impact our air quality. And switching out those fireplaces into cleaner devices or going all out to electric it can make a huge difference.
Yeah, it was sad when I had to let go of my fireplace because there's something romantic about it's cold outside. It's probably the holiday season. You're lighting a fire, you're sitting with a cup of coffee. But at the end of the day, and we're about to talk about health outcomes with air quality, at the end of the day, some things it's just maybe time to let go of. And that you could still, I feel like you can still get a romantic feeling from looking at a gas furnace burning or something. I don't know. That's
What
maybe
I
just
do
me.
in my house is having little kids, I turn on the frozen Yule log on
Oh yeah, like the
Disney.
Netflix, yeah, Yule
Yes.
Log or whatever. Yeah.
And you
That
just have it.
definitely works. There's one with I'm forgetting the actor's name, but he plays a character in Parks and Recreation called Ron Swanson, and it's just him sitting by a fireplace drinking a glass of whiskey in an armchair, and he just sits there for 6 hours. That usually does it for me. My next question is a little complicated, but I just wanted to talk to you about disentangling things. So oftentimes, we talk about health outcomes related to air quality. I'll read statistics published in major newspapers that describe the number of people who die a year from poor air quality across the world. And I always wonder how you disentangle all the confounding variables at work there, because there's just so many: food, generational trauma, violence. There's so many things at work. So how do we actually narrow down that poor air quality is going to lead to higher mortality rates or higher rates of asthma? Asthma is maybe a little bit more simple to directly correlate, but for those broader, bigger, scarier statistics that we see, how do we know?
It is a number of things really coming, and this is why I love that science can be going from the lab all the way to the human experience, because you really need all of it to understand the health impacts of something like air pollution. So what we know is that from all the way from studies in the lab to being able to look at, let's say, for example, all the emergency room or all the hospitalization data in California, what that can tell us, and how you can rule out some other things in particular studies to say, you know what, it wasn't their diabetes, it wasn't their pre ex other existing condition. We can say that over this relationship proves true. And so at the California Air Resources Board, that's what we do to establish what we call the health endpoints, where we say we know from lab to human that these particular illnesses are not only related, but we can see causal links. We can see along the line where these things were impacted by air pollution at one point or another. And we know that's like a grid. So it's not everything is definitely, we know for sure. There's like suggestive things there where we're getting to understand as the research emerges. So when I was starting out school, there was very little understanding. There had been like fringe studies that understood that maybe something like thyroid disease could be impacted by air pollution. Now we know that there are definitely some metabolic effects. There's even fertility effects that we didn't know that are suggesting that there may be a relationship. That comes again from studying it in the lab, studying it where you can say, hey, this cell, this is what happened to it when we exposed it to this mouse model. This is what happened when we exposed it to now looking at the emergency department and hospitalization data across California or across the nation, really. But now what we know is that, for example, particulate matter 2.5, which is what we struggle with the most in the San Joaquin Valley, is that we know for sure we can see that there are cardiovascular effects that are linking PM 2.5 and the effect of on a human body. So people often don't think about, wow, there's high pollution and people are also going into the emergency room for heart-related things. We don't often think about those as being related, but the evidence really points that they are.
I remember a few years ago, I was in a swimming pool and it was during the Creek Fire. And I remember ash falling down onto the surface of the pool water. We have a perpetual fire season in California. Are there certain things that we can do preventatively for the city of Fresno to support people when those inevitable events happen, when the air quality is affected by ash and smoke?
One thing that we have seen is that, again, going back to those green spaces, that tree canopy, is that when we have that green stuff, whether it's the right kinds of bushes, the right kinds of trees, those can actually serve as a mask that our community can wear. And we see that community by community, they will have different health effects. They could live under the same air basin, but if you have more tree cover, you will have less emergency visits because of respiratory issues. And so investing in more of that type of community level prevention is really key. And also, I do think that it pains me so much when I see that there are bad air events happening, and I go out and kids are still at football practice. Kids are still at soccer practice or at baseball practice. I think integrating that knowledge into our youth sports culture is really important. And I know it's hard because so many of our kids, so many parents are really invested in those sports for their kids to be able to afford college or see them their career. So I know that parents tend to be very invested in those. And so the schools are invested in those as well. They can be money makers. And I think that we need to change the paradigm to really think about the sacrifice that we're making on that young person's body and the toll that we're asking that young body to take every time they're out there in a bad air event. I think sometimes it's education. So I'm working with the air district to be much more, and they have been much more engaged with schools than they were even like 15 years ago. But we definitely need more of that type of interaction and sort of acceptance.
Yeah, no touchdown is worth the outcomes of bad air quality when you're, and I generally check my phone. I like to run. That's my kind of activity of choice. And running outside is usually the best, but I generally try to check the air quality before I go outside. For if you're, let's say someone's looking at their phone to their little Apple weather, is there a certain threshold of like poor air quality where you wouldn't do anything physical outside? What's your personal threshold?
So personally, I will say that for me, we will begin limiting things at what our air quality meter says is the moderate level, just
Okay.
because we do have asthma in our family. Unfortunately, three out of the four of us have asthma, and my son and I have severe asthma, meaning we have to take medication every day. And when we get a respiratory illness, it is really important to manage that very carefully. So for us, it's really at moderate. We start thinking, okay, we're not going to be out there like for a whole hour. We'll limit it to about 20 minutes. But really, where we say nobody's going outside, it is that next level, which is what you may see as on the color coded as the orange level, which is unhealthy for sensitive groups. And again, sometimes people don't realize that you're in a sensitive group. So, for example, pregnant women are a sensitive group. And so, if you see level three as a pregnant woman, you really should not be out there because it does increase your chances of things like preterm birth. And people with asthma, definitely anybody with a heart condition can fall under that sensitive group. So, that's a lot of us in the San Joaquin Valley, unfortunately. So really for me, that level three is we're going to rethink our activities, and where even the healthiest person should be indoors is that purple level, and definitely no sports or anything should be happening when that's in the very unhealthy level.
Yeah, I definitely feel personally checked by that answer. So I need to probably change some activities. All right, just a few more questions before we wrap up. If you could make one major infrastructure change to Fresno to improve health outcomes, let's say you were the czar of infrastructure for a little while, what would you change?
Oh my gosh, yes. So you have gone into my dreams and actually
Okay.
doubt what
Oh, fantastic.
I would love to be for a day. Yes, some people would want to be like a famous social media star. No, I would want to be the czar of infrastructure.
Fantastic. What would you change?
One of the things that I would do is make it a lot easier, permitting wise, bureaucracy wise, to have infill development. So, building inside communities that are already existing would be my number one priority, making it easier and more affordable for people to do, including developers. The next thing I would do is I would definitely make public transportation a priority. And this is very hard to do because you do have to change the culture of how people do their daily lives. And it's one of those where we have seen that if you build it, they do come. That's induced demand. That's why when you build an extra freeway lane, you have the same amount of traffic, right?
Yeah, FACTS just got, I think $50 million is what they just got. They just got a big grant. So
Yeah.
you would use that to increase routes or more buses, or what would you do?
Oh, definitely more routes and really think through where those people need to get to. So not just building more routes for more routes' sake, but where do people, like, let's say that live in my community, Sanger, where do they commute to? Let's build a route for them to get to where they need to go. And the final thing, which I've mentioned several times here, is green space, building up that tree canopy, building up in an inable way, because we know that water is an issue and we want to continue to be responsible. Even if we're not in a drought, we want to continue to be responsible. So I would definitely say building the right tree canopy for our community would be a key priority.
Okay. What's your general perspective on some of these anti-camping ordinances? How can we help people make healthier choices while also giving people autonomy to make decisions for themselves? It's such a complicated question. I was curious about your health lens and how you would think about it from that perspective.
Yeah, so I actually think about it from a starting from a community engagement perspective. What do people actually want? Where do they, what services do they want? And is there a missed connection between what they actually want and what they're receiving? Because maybe what they want is actually help navigating Social Security, which is really being difficult and helping them get the right services that they need, the right checks, the right way that they need. Maybe it's more independent living association housing where they can have some freedom, but also have be able to live in a space that where they have some independence and accountability at the same time. I don't know what they need, and that's the problem. And so we say, and so one of the things that I've been concerned about is that with these ordinances, there are sweeps and people refuse services, but there's no, for me, I lack the understanding of were those services actually services that they wanted or that they needed that we tried to hook them up with, or was there a disconnect? And
Yeah,
if
and I feel
so,
like
how would you
some
make
of
that
those,
happen?
I feel like some of those need assessments can be pretty loaded. Where and are they being filled out with fidelity? Are people being guided to certain answers based on the city's motives? And yeah, it seems super complicated to ascertain people's actual needs and desires. We're going to close with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
Oh, so many really fun books. I think if you want to understand a little bit about where I come from in terms of what has shaped my thinking, it's definitely anything written by Pierre Bourdieu, who was a sociologist, a French sociologist, and really talked about how some of the ways that we make these decisions continue to build inequality, but how much of that social and cultural piece can actually be tangibly important
Is there a
to
good
people.
entry point book for his research that you would recommend, or just really any of his books?
I think if we had to, if I had to pick one, it would definitely just be like The Logic of Practice, I think is a good one. And I would also say that on a personal, totally like fun level, I think one of the quote unquote overrated, underrated poets is Gibran Khalil Gibran. He was a Lebanese American writer, poet. I love all of his writings. There's so much wisdom. So definitely, that's those are the two that I, off the top of my head, that I would recommend.
All right. And last question. What are you working on next?
We are in right now, we are in the building out the next way to think about community health workers. We got to test that out a lot in the during the pandemic and help people see the value of something that we had been talking about for over a decade at the Institute, but now we're really thinking about how to think about integrating them within the healthcare system and within our social systems in a great way. So one of the ways that we're doing that is we're engaged in the community schools conversation as the education system has shift is shifting through some of this investment to think about family housing and family economics and wellness as a part of a kid's education. We're entering with that community health worker perspective to help. How does the attendance counselor have that mindset? How does the school nurse have that mindset of community? And how does that change then what happens in the school space as well? So that I'm really excited about.
Dr. Pacheco Warner, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you so much, Jordan, for the invitation.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.